KUER News in Salt Lake City. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Catherine Cole's mother has PhDs in geology and psychology. Her father's a mathematician. One brother is a mathematical economist, the other a mechanical engineer. Her husband is a computer scientist. And she, as you may know, is a poet. And why she didn't become a scientist herself is a good question. Maybe I'll ask her. There were other things she thought about doing in her life. Be a fireman and a poet, a marine biologist and a poet, a lawyer and a poet, an architect and a poet. Today in the program, Catherine Coles will join us to talk about her life and work and how she manages to filter so many interests and passions through words and verse. They're all different lenses that shape the way she writes about the world. Join us after the news.
Hello, podcast listener. It's Elaine Clark, one of the producers for Radio West. You'll notice today's show is a little bit shorter than usual. It's because it's KUER Spring Fund Drive, so you're missing out on several minutes of appeal to support KUER, Radio West, and the podcast you're listening to. But you're savvy. You know how it works. KUER relies on your support to make this all possible. If you're already a sustainer, thank you. If not, you can join us for as little as $5 a month. Just go to our website, radiowest.org. And thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. You sometimes hear from stand-up comics that it's hard to do comedy if you have a happy childhood. Don't they say comedy, the good stuff anyway, comes from pain? And is the same true for artists, that you need trauma to make art? In the early days, the poet Catherine Coles tried to write poems that were autobiographical, but she said she couldn't make a career out of it because she had an uneventful upbringing. You can only make so much hay out of a happy childhood, she said. And so she began to look for another kind of poem to write, one that reflected her experience in another way. Her poetry then has been drawn from so many things. Her latest book is taken from science and philosophy and art and history. That book is called Flight, and it's just giving us an excuse to talk with her about her book and about her life. Catherine Coles is a professor of English at the University of Utah, where she co-directs the Utah Symposium in Science and Literature. You probably know she's, of course, former Utah Poet Laureate. Flight, the book we'll talk about, is her sixth collection of poetry. It was written alongside her last book, The Earth Is Not Flat, which was part of the National Science Foundation's Antarctic Artists and Writers Program. And Catherine Coles is joining us in the studio. And welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Doug, for having me.
Uneventful? What does that mean? Happy? Here's one thing you said about your childhood. There was a lot of boredom. Meaning what? You were always looking for something to do?
I was left to my own devices, you know, in a way that I think that children aren't anymore. Yeah. And the world, I believe that we know for a fact that the world was not a safer place for children then. But we lived as if it were a safer place for children. And I think we also lived as if a certain amount of accident and mishap was part of a normal childhood. I think that kids maybe make it to adulthood now without ever breaking a bone, and that's not something that would have been really imagined, or, you know, with no trips to the emergency room. And certainly in my family, that would have been an unimaginable outcome. So on the one hand, I claim to have had an uneventful childhood. And then when I'm really forced to think about it, of course, there were events. But back to your question, I was a daydreamy kid, and I was allowed to daydream. And the only rule was that if I were found reading indoors in summer, I would be required to take the book outside.
Wow. So what did they say, your mom and your dad? Get out of here. Go do something. I don't really care what. Just leave.
Yeah. They would say, go outside. It's a beautiful day. What are you doing in here? You can take the book if you want to.
Yeah. And did you take the book outside?
Very often.
Yeah.
I did. But, you know, outside is pretty interesting. Mm-hmm. It competes with the book in the way that inside doesn't compete with the book.
I wonder if one of the things you've said is that you were pretty young when you taught yourself to read. Did you mean that? You actually taught yourself to read?
Yeah, I remember the moment when I was 3 years old when the book I had memorized and, you know, I would turn the pages and recite it, that suddenly it resolved into something that made sense on the page. It was a red letter moment for me.
In what way? Like, in what way? Just because now all of a sudden you get that there is an origin for these stories, that someone is writing these stories? I mean, what was it?
I don't think I did at that point, yeah. But it represented, that moment represented a kind of freedom for me. I didn't need anyone anymore to read the books to me. I could read them as I wished. And my parents were very liberal in the sense of allowing us access to anything that was on their shelves, to anything that was in the library. And so I was reading books for grown-ups in pretty short order and was allowed really to roam very freely in the world of print. I was probably 5 or 6 when I realized that somebody actually wrote the books that I was reading.
Yeah. Did you think, at what point in that process then did you start to think that, okay, I'm 6 now, I see that someone's writing this, they're creating this story, this is what I want to do? Like, when did the writing part of it for yourself occur to you?
My mother has poems from when I was 6 and 7 years old. And, you know, I like to think that in the very instant I knew somebody wrote things, that would have been the moment that I decided I wanted to do that. And that might, in fact, be true. But I don't remember the moment in the same way I remember learning to read.
But the earliest things you were writing were poems. Isn't that interesting?
The earliest things were poems.
They weren't stories. They weren't little novels, little novellas or anything like that.
Mm-mm. Definitely poems. And I think that part of that is being raised in the Episcopalian church and exposure to the liturgy. But there was also poetry in the house.
You were drawn to poems?
I was drawn to poems. I think I really loved the magic of poetry, the way in which one word becomes another word that sounds like it, the way in which one thing through metaphor magically becomes another thing. You know, I really think that poetry is related to magical incantation as well as to religious incantation. And in my liturgy, you spoke the words and wine became blood and bread became flesh.
Yeah. Someone asked you once if there was a spiritual component to your poetry. And here's where you said, well, that's problematic for me because I am, and this is how you put it, an outright atheist.
Yeah.
But you also said that the idea of things that bring us into contact with the numinous, you're okay with that. Like you like that.
I'm not only okay with it, I'm deeply committed to it.
Yeah. Isn't it true? Yeah.
And I'm deeply committed to the knowledge that the world and the universe are larger than I am, that most of what's in it I don't know. The thing I have trouble committing to is the idea that we would reduce that to a singular deity who looks strangely like us.
See, here's the thing that I think is interesting about that, and I wonder if this is part of the appeal of poetry. Hmm. Poetry, it's hard to be reductive about good poetry. It's hard to, and believe me, I'm going to try today to get you to talk about what this poem is about, which you don't like to talk about. You like to say how it works as opposed to what it's about.
Yeah.
But poetry takes more effort. It's more complex in some ways, the way you have to think about it, the way you have to. Is that part of the draw for you?
Yeah, I mean, poetry is very nuanced, and it does, I think, good poetry refuse to reduce the world, and I prefer to live in an unreduced world. It's just a lot more exciting.
You have talked about. Poet was always attached to this. I wanted to be a fireman and a poet, and I wanted to be a marine biologist and a poet, and an attorney and a poet, and an actor and a poet. So they were always connected. The poet was always the constant, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And I think that maybe at the age of seven, when I announced I was going to be a fireman and a poet, I understood already that, you know, you couldn't make a living writing poetry.
Yeah.
You know, or maybe I understood that I would always need to have something else to be bringing to the poetry.
Yeah.
I'm a big believer, actually, in content. Not everybody is who is involved in poetry. So it might have been a combination of those things. It took, I was 20 before I was willing to say I just wanted to be a poet. Hmm. And that felt like a risk to me to do that.
And what did your parents say when you settled on that?
My mother, she might not remember it exactly this way, but we would talk on the phone every Sunday. And my recollection is that every single Sunday she would say, it's not too late to be an engineer.
Right.
You know,
right.
Because obviously I had those, you know, skills and gifts. They were present in my family. And then she stopped saying that. Mm. And then eventually I noticed that she had stopped saying that. And I asked her about it. And she said, well, you know, your father and I have realized, I think first they realized that there were living poets, because there was a, when I was growing up as a poet, Frost was dead.
Yeah.
And the burgeoning of the poetry world hadn't really happened yet. So I think that that was the first thing that happened. And then she said, we've realized that if you need to wait tables for a living, you'll get by.
Wow.
And a lot of my friends thought that that was an insult. But actually, waitressing was a highly regarded profession in my family.
Really?
Yeah.
So. I like the actor and poet part, the acting part. Did you entertain that idea of – I mean, I, when I think – and people will hear this later when you read, there's such a performance aspect to it. Mm-hmm. I think for all – probably all poets, I suppose, in some way. But the acting part, how long did you entertain that idea of being an actor?
I studied it quite – seriously, I acted in high school, and I did some community theater and some theater at the University of Washington. And I actually found acting to be too frighteningly intimate.
Wow.
An art. I felt too exposed on the stage as an introvert, which I think most poets are introverts. And that might sound contradictory because, of course, poems are very intimate. But you get to navigate that space as a poet alone in your room in your pajamas before you're performing the poem. And so the moment of real exposure or intimacy has already gone by the time you're mm-hmm. reading the poem to an audience.
Do you see yourself as having to be vulnerable? I mentioned this in the introduction, that for a while you thought, oh, maybe I can try autobiography, but it's not the kind of poetry that seems to work for me.
Mm-hmm.
Was that in any way you sort of resisting that impulse of being too exposed?
You know, I don't think so. I think it just those stories didn't interest me.
Yeah.
And in fact, as my poems have become in some ways less straightforwardly autobiographical in the sense of I say this happened to me and then this happened to me and here's how I felt about it, I actually think that as they enact what I am interested in, which is a kind of passionate thinking, that they're much more intimate and therefore more vulnerable than the earlier, more autobiographical poems.
It's that's something I wanted to ask you about, actually. And I was going to sort of wait until later, but I want to get that sense. This passionate thinking, which goes back to the days of you daydreaming, I'm supposing,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And you talk about how – you've talked about how poetry gives a kind of structure and a discipline to those abstract daydreams,
mm-hmm.
that passionate thinking? Is that right?
I also think that poetry quite literally makes demands on the body.
On the physical body?
On the physical body. Poetry lives in the mouth.
Yeah.
Poetry lives in the ear.
Yeah.
It lives in the heartbeat. It enacts a physical relationship with the world that also is abstracted in some way. So poetry enables me to think of thinking as a full body experience, which I believe ideally it is a full body experience. And so I really actually have come to mistrust the mind-body divide. I believe that I have a mind, but I believe it does not exist separately from my body. And I think that it doesn't only live in my head. I think it lives in my whole body. I believe I have a soul, but I think it doesn't live separately from my body. I think it inhabits my entire body and arises from my body and will probably go wherever my body goes. Once things are all over. So, you know, that goes back to the question about religion and spiritual life.
Yeah. So this idea that poetry is some sort of cerebral form must drive you crazy.
Well, it's not my experience.
Yeah. but what do you mean that it because you're reading it, it becomes physical? Or what did you mean by heartbeat? The way we're hearing the rhythms of a poem is resonating with the rhythm of our own body? Is that what you mean?
The heartbeat is iambic.
Yeah.
Ba-bum, ba-bum. And, you know, the iamb is the classic metrical foot of English language poetry. French is different. Italian is different. I wouldn't claim that English is therefore closer to the heart, but this is the way that I experience it in my English language body. And it's not only the heartbeat. We have all kinds of rhythms operating in our bodies all the time, the footstep, the hand gesture. And all of these things, I think, are enacted in a poem.
You've said that poetry directs you beyond narcissism. It turns the daydream, the passionate thinking, into something, here's how you put it, more generous.
I hope so.
That's the idea, right? Mm-hmm. So is the first impulse in a poem, and you've talked about this, is kind of selfishness. Like that's where it begins. And so part of the process of writing a poem, if I get this right, is it may start selfish, but it has to end up, or should end up, if you're doing it right, I guess, generous. So what does that mean? Like in a place where it's not just about you. That, I mean, if it works, it extends itself, what, outward?
Outward. So a poem, Archie Ammons actually has a wonderful description of writing poetry where he says it starts as an anxiety in the self. And anxiety is not exactly the word that I would use, but a kind of pressure, a kind of urgency. And then that the job of writing the poem is actually to take that anxiety and move it out of the self. And into the world. And I think he means that generously. But I agree with that. And I would say that whatever it is, that pressure of experience, of thinking something, of working your way through something, that as you move that out into the world in the shape of the poem where you can see it and work on it, the rest of the work becomes creating in that space that's now outside of you a space for the reader to inhabit. So you've had a kind of thinking experience. And then the idea is that even though you're in a different time and a different place, you have a little door in that experience that the reader can come in and share the experience with you. It's not the same experience because the reader brings his or her own urgencies and histories, etc. But you have this little place where that meeting occurs between two people who are absent from each other.
When did you start to realize that?
Oh, that's really a good question. Probably when I was in college. Huh. I think that the teen years are pretty narcissistic.
Yeah. Naturally.
Yeah. I mean, we're supposed to be, right, narcissists, and we expect that everybody is going to be interested in us. I mean, when I teach I get my hands on the 18, 19, 20-year-olds, right, what I have to do is remind them, I'm not your mother. I'm not your best friend.
Right.
You actually have to earn the attention of the stranger because you're asking that person to give their mortality to the moment that you've created.
Here's your quote. You've said, you tell students, the reader doesn't care about your experience. She cares about her own experience.
That's exactly right. And, you know, they come to that really quickly when you ask them on the first day, what do you read? they know that, yeah. Right? And then you say, why do you write? And they get this look on their face. It's like, oh, I think I see where this is going.
I want to ask about your folks. Mm. They seem to have had a profound influence, obviously, on your perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Your mother and father, there's a terrific – and by the way, it's on our website – photograph that Elaine Clark, our producer, found from the Salt Lake Tribune of Catherine Coles. How old were you?
8.
8 years old. In an Easter dress, although no one can see the Easter dress, and you have a little scarf on your head, and you are you're in crutches, and you are attending, because it made it into the paper, Martin Luther King rally? Protest?
It was
town?
A silent march. Mm. It occurred 3 days after his assassination. And Elaine tells me that today's the anniversary of the assassination of Martin Luther King. So this occurred on Sunday, 3 days later, a week before Easter Sunday. And it was a silent, single-file march. I can't remember how far we ran.
But your parents said what? This is important, we're going, or was it expected? Do you remember anything about that part?
My parents were very – they let us choose most things. And I don't remember – I should remember, but I don't – whether my brothers were there or not. But we all would have had the choice to do what we wanted.
Your mother was one of the first women to climb Grand Teton.
That's my understanding.
It's the story. We're sticking to it, right?
Yeah.
And but what it says to me, though, is that this idea of Catherine, go outside, that was embedded in the sort of the family idea that mm-hmm. we go outside. This is where life happens, too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Yeah, very much so. Very much so. And so when I was a kid on Friday afternoons in good weather, they would throw the kids in the back of the old International Travel All in our pajamas, and we would wake up in Arches National Park. Yeah.
There is there are two poems I want to ask you about from The One Right Touch. This was your first book of poetry,
mm-hmm.
yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And there's this I'm not sure how much of this you want to read or just talk about, but there's a poem called My Mother's Lesson.
Do you want me to read it?
Yeah, why don't you?
Okay.
Because it's such a startling story. Do you want to read it first? Do you want to say something?
Yeah, I can read it. I will say that my mother now writes poetry, but when I wrote this book, she didn't. My theft of the story was innocent.
Because this is her story to tell, but you've done it.
Yeah.
Well, it's your mom.
My mother's lesson. In the car, she shifts down and leans to the wheel. In her throat, rising scales the teacher will pull through her all morning. She enters her body's tentative music, her voice faltering upward. She wants to discover how some, in tune, work inward and bring out the notes joined, as if they had always meant to gather into sound out of nothing. At a stoplight, she looks around, a schoolyard gritty with snow, bare trees and wires, and on the corner, a man she has not seen before, and a pistol shoulder high, apparently trained on her blue silk scarf. Calm, she shifts, pulls through the unchanged red light, and is gone. The man behind her now and his gun unchanged, still silent, the only explosion the one she sounds and resounds in her mind, and only that. None of love's tensions or wounds between them, no jealousy, dissonant notes, an enigma. Blocks away, she glances back, drives on, nothing, she says, left to chance. At her lesson, she starts, stumbles, and the metronome counts her beyond her own compromising rhythm, and this is the best she's ever sung, abandoned to the rise, the dying fall. Her voice loosens a music she has always felt playing through her body's cadence. She carries one phrase so wide it presses her ribcage. Opens her throat, climbs into the sweet, dangerous air of release, her voice pushing past notes recklessly, reclaiming moment after free moment, exactly as they occur to her. I haven't read that in years.
Really? Because it's, what was it like reading it?
It was interesting. I remembered it.
Do you?
Yeah.
Such a beautiful story and such a dark story. How do you talk about it? Do you talk about the thing that happened that day?
She told me the story. I think it happened maybe when I was living away from Salt Lake, but it might have been when I was here. It's the school that's on 3rd Avenue and E Street, which many of the listeners will know. So she told me about it on the phone, and I lived with it, I don't even think for very long. I might have written the poem the very same day, partly as my way of processing what she told me. And for her, the takeaway was that she had never sung so well.
Yeah.
And for me, that juxtaposition of the jarring event and then the body's release into music is the thing that I wanted to portray.
Catherine Coles is with us. We'll return from a break talking about her new book, which is called Flight. Let me mention that this particular poem she just read is called My Mother's Lesson. It's from her first book of poetry called The One Right Touch. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us poet Catherine Coles. She's joining us here in the studio. She has a new book of poetry, her sixth, called Flight. So Flight was a book that you started before, or right alongside anyway, The Earth is Not Flat. And that was a book that I think people remember. We've talked to you about this on the show when you went to Antarctica. Mm-hmm. What was interesting about The Earth Is Not Flat is I think it's a book that you said you've had to kind of turn around fairly quickly. This book you had been working alongside. So what's the relationship between the two books?
Well, so I started Flight before I ever even knew I was going to Antarctica. I tend to be a kind of slow, meditative, thoughtful writer more than now. I think actually the experience of writing The Earth Is Not Flat has loosened me up a little bit. But this one was started well before I went to Antarctica and was finished at nearly the same time as the Antarctica book. So this one was written maybe over 5 years. Mm-hmm. And that one was written in under a year, which for me is incredibly
crazy fast.
And my publisher decided, and partly because I had some things in this one that I was still kind of fiddling with, it being the slower, more thoughtful book, and my publisher said, let's just go with the Antarctica book and put that one out first. And then this one trails along behind as the thing that sort of wraps around that book in a way.
You mentioned this earlier, that it's your later poems, the ones you're doing now, are the least autobiographical, yet they're the most intimate.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about refraction, because to me, it seems to be really personal and on some level kind of autobiographical, at least. I mean, you refer to the mathematician.
Mm-hmm.
You refer to the daydreaming.
Mm-hmm.
And there seems to be these references of the passing of time, which, hey, none of us are getting any younger, so these must be things you're reflecting on. Do you want to read it first and then we can talk about it, or do you want to say something about the way you were thinking about this?
Let's read it and then talk about it. It's called Refraction, and it literally refers to refraction. And I guess the only thing that I would say about it is that this poem was written before I went to Antarctica.
Wow.
Which is interesting because refraction is everything in the Antarctic landscape, the ways in which light is behaving. And it took me a while to get used to being able to see the world in Antarctica. And really the thing that the reference point for that became the desert, because light also behaves strangely in the desert. Anyway, refraction. Because time passes more slowly in water than in air, everything floats. Muscle, memory, and bone, all anything but light. I take my time, roundabout detour and angle, to get to the point, even into your arms. Did you know a single point of light departs a crystal in so many directions at once? Say teepee, say traffic cone, say sorcerer's hat glammed with stars, both straight and wayward. Oh, my searchlight, consider the mathematician noodling around like any poet, dreaming the improbable, then all at once stumbling over something useful? Not yet. Centuries from now. Still, what's a dreamer only ever after beauty to do? Rub her eyes, bemused, shuck her jammies, check her watch, go out for beer. I am on the verge every moment of mislaying credit card, laptop, wits. Even you, my bête blanc, my obstacle, my great good dirigible, my distraction. I ask, how do we live in this world, knowing only everything we do?
Yet on the verge of misplacing the credit card and the laptop and the end of the wit. So that's it's this bigger metaphor here, mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's
and it seems deeply intimate. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is deeply intimate and in a weird way kind of confessional.
It's totally.
Right? But not confessional in the way of, you know, I cheated on my spouse and I did this and I did that. It's really confessional about character.
Yeah.
And confessional about what it is to be human and flawed and losing track, right? Isn't being an adult, the long process of losing track of everything, in a way. And I think that so for me to say that is more difficult than to say any number of other things.
The theme, I guess, is, or at least the way you've been thinking about this collection, is the way which makes refraction as a title makes sense, lenses, right?
Mm-hmm.
The
mm-hmm.
lenses that we filter our experiences.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Yeah. And I mean lenses in the literal sense.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a literal refraction going on here, thinking about how that works in terms of optics, et cetera, but also all of these kinds of metaphorical lenses that we use. And so my mother's lesson, the story she told me, is a lens that I use for looking at, right?
Yeah.
Other questions, other kinds of issues. Here, the literal refraction becomes a lens that I use for thinking about other kinds of refraction, including the ways in which our identities, right, are not as singular as we imagine them to
be. Well, because I think about the lens is your eye.
Mm-hmm.
But then it raises that sort of deeply existential question about what am I perceiving here?
Mm-hmm.
Is it real?
Mm-hmm.
What is real? What is reality? It seems like you're working through those things too.
Yeah, I am very, very much so. I'm interested in this question, and you may have gathered that that my desire is to occupy all possible positions at the same time.
Of course.
So on the one hand, I am raised in postmodernism. I understand constructivism. I understand, this idea that we actually can't know anything and we filter everything through language. It's, it's only our own subject position that we had, et cetera, et cetera. But I am also deeply a positivist. I think this is my, scientific family and background, I believe that there is a reality, and I believe that we can know something about it, right? So these are just two apparently contradictory ideas that that I live with both at the same time, and obviously not always very comfortably, but happily.
Well, this says everything about your life, you know, living with a husband who's a computer scientist and a, you know, father who was who's a mathematician, and you've, brothers who are mechanical engineers, and, you know, I mean, it's all about that science. And then yet somehow early on, before science could take hold, poetry did, right?
Yeah. You know, so that – well, and one thing that I would say, my husband's PhD is in physics.
Yeah.
And my dad's a mathematician. My mom's a geologist and a psychologist,
yep.
Right? And I would argue that physics and mathematics are deeply creative. I would argue that inventing – with the materials of the world is deeply creative. And so when Chris and I first got married and our friend said, huh, a physicist and a poet, what do you talk about? The answer to that was, well, everything. We talk about everything. And we came to understand that in our work as well as in our lives, we actually have a lot more in common.
There's another false division then, mind, yeah. Body, science, art.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Yeah.
And that, you know, I think that my focus on lenses, if I can say such a silly thing, you know, is really about acknowledging and understanding that that all of these lenses help us both to an accurate perception and to a creative perception of the world we live in,
yeah.
If we're serious.
Yeah. All right. I don't want to go off too far, but I don't think it does. But I'm wondering where 30 Years with These Lions fits in that scheme. Because I loved this poem. And I think people who live in the city, in Salt Lake City, will have an affinity for it because you'll know the you'll know these figures.
I think that's right. And there's a little bit of a fib in this poem in that I speak as if I know the woman in this house and if she's my actual neighbor, and that part of it is actually invented. So I should confess to that, especially just in case the people who live in this house are listening.
Right.
But the house is on 5th East below Liberty Park, probably about 12th South or so. 30 years with these lions. I have seen them in Taipei guarding museum steps, in Kamakura temples guarding their own myth, winged and guarding time's passage at San Marco. Excavated in Istanbul's galleries, they become inscrutable the further they erode. Once we took our lions literally. They stalked our caves and dogged our steps before we posed them. We knew if we lay down just what we were doing, what it meant to invite them in. I don't know why we set them in stone. Take my neighbor, her tiny bungalow. Her husband dead, she placed these lions to flank her abbreviated walkway, a gate between them, though she has no fence. Their heads, curled locks flowing European style, almost reach her eaves, as if they might protect her just by looming. In their calm, they keep confusion at bay, the local toughs, his ghost. Look at that paw, its delicate lift, claws retracted for the long moment. 90 last summer, sharp, still ready, she moves off her porch to draw me through the gate.
It's interesting you say there's a fib there. What's wrong with you creating a story of the person who lives behind that
house? I think there's no,
obviously
there's
not.
Nothing wrong with it. But I do know that there are readers, and this is maybe a whole another conversation, who really, because lyric poetry is so intimate,
yep.
And this is a very intimate poem, right? They expect, therefore, that you are telling the autobiographical truth at every moment. And in fact, I tell the autobiographical truth only when it makes a poem better to do it.
Is that right?
Yeah, yeah. And if I need to torque the truths, right? This poem took off for me when I imagined the relationship between Kate, the speaker,
yeah,
and this woman.
Yeah. What? When we had a relationship.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's where.
When she said, come in, come on in, Kate.
Come on in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's the clincher, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And do you work backward from that?
No, no. I start with all those different kinds of lions that I've seen all over the world and then placing these local lions, right, into context. And then from there.
Really?
Making the
wow.
next imaginative step. Yeah. So that the first part of that poem actually came from notes and notebooks from my travels, far from home.
Yeah.
And then thinking, what is it with the lions?
Yes.
Right?
And there are lions on Fifth East.
And there are lions on Fifth East
yeah.
and also
yeah.
on 11th Avenue.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. Right, of course.
So
there's a poem called Poems 2.0. I want to ask you about this because in some ways, Kate, the way I experienced the poem, it seems like in some way you're pushing back on the assumptions of poetry. Rethinking, maybe not rethinking, but thinking differently in some ways about the poetry you've been writing over these years, whether you've gotten it right all of these years, whether poetry can get it right. What are you thinking about when you wrote this poem?
Yeah, I am asking some questions about some things that major poets have said in this poem, and I think that many of your readers will recognize, you know, I wandered lonely as a cloud and the poetry of the earth is ceasing never, right, et cetera, those kinds of lines. And then, you know, again, in the progression of the poem, what I come to question is my own poems, because it seems to me that it's not really fair to attack Wordsworth without thinking a little harder, right, about
your own work.
About your own practices. And, you know, one of the things that I think about poetry right now at the age of almost 57 is that it's a lifelong process of, as my dear friend Ken Brewer would have said, missing the mark, right, of always, you know, working towards something and maybe never quite getting it.
Read this, would you?
Poems 2.0, and I will say that this is in numbered sections, but I'm not going to read the numbers. Poems 2.0. They were in error, of course, about most things. The clouds never were soft. Inside, rambunctious then as now, they struck and swizzled, composing pockets of violence, electrified. They had no time to think of being lonely. And the poetry of the earth, it could cease. We know that now. Flowers, for example, will take and take, will lash and tooth the air, will scatter and dig in and rise above themselves and flourish. Do not mistake me. This is no correction. Don't ask me to count the ways I have been wrong about love's same old la-di-da, or how I knew all along I could only betray the flesh that dazzled me into song, my own or his. A poem might have told us in so many words and others and been wrong.
When did you write that?
Fairly recently.
Yeah.
It was maybe the last, well, one of the last poems anyway.
Is that where you're thinking these days? Just about, and I mean, I'm wondering how that sensibility is influencing the things you're writing now.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think I used to think of my poems as being kind of cut in stone, right? Like those lions chiseled, and you know, one always hopes that one has written one thing that will last. But I'm really much more now thinking of every poem as provisional. Much more than I ever have before. And, you know, maybe that will change again. I will have been wrong about that. But right now, I occupy a position in a poem, and that may or may not be the position that I'm occupying in the next poem, which could be tomorrow's poem.
And you reserve that right to just that this is the way it works for me.
This is the way it works for me right now.
Yeah. Catherine Coles, poet and professor of English at the University of Utah. Her new book is called Flight. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure.
Radio West, production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.